Welcome to No Hype, the podcast about truth, science, and the future of marketing. Brought to you by your hosts, Allison Dietz
and Brett House.
Today's No Hype guest is Matt Daly, founder and consultant at Effective Media Consulting, based in the UK. Matt is a 23-year performance veteran turned marketing effectiveness leader and is the former chief performance officer at Havas. During his long career in the industry, Matt has helped brands and agencies of all sizes better understand the true contribution of media to drive incremental business growth. He's worked hard to break down the silos of brand and performance and has developed innovative measurement approaches to prove what's really working. Matt, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
So, Matt, great to have you on the podcast. We know that we've worked with you in the past and in the UK at various events. And would love for you to share with the audience a little bit about your journey in marketing and what led you to found the Effective Media consulting organization that you're now running.
Thanks, Brett. It's really great to be here and thank you for the invite. I am a bit of a veteran. I started back in 1999 my first media agency, and I started in offline. There wasn't really a lot of digital around back then. There's a couple of guys in the corner building websites, but that was pretty much it from an advertising point of view. So I started off in TV, inserts, print magazines, things like that. But always direct response. So, you know, all those good old fashioned ways of trying to get people to call a number, send in a coupon, respond by mail or phone. And then as sort of digital started to take over, probably around about 2005, 2006, as search had really developed, display was, you know, in full sort of flow. And I changed agencies and I took over a digital specialist team. Because I think what I found was that all of those principles that I'd spent those years learning for offline media, they still applied. It was just being activated in a different way. And actually, I think, you know, search found this perfect combination of advertising channel and response channel, which just brought the two areas together. And so those channels really started to grow and dominate, and clients were putting more and more budgets into those digital channels. But I always had, I think, a healthy sort of skepticism of digital. You know, I could see its value, but as it really started to dominate and clients' budgets were just moving wholesale into those areas, I did start to question whether this kind of drive for efficiency was overcoming the more important drive for effectiveness in advertising and in brand health and long-term growth. And so probably the last 5 or 10 years, I've really been working with clients to try and establish the true value of media and try and overcome some of this loss of effectiveness that lots of people in the industry have been talking about for the last, you know, 5, 10 years, and help sort of turn that into actual strategies and ways of, you know, redefining the value of digital, but also the overall contribution of different media channels to genuine business growth.
Matt, can I ask you to just help explain? Maybe most of our audience is familiar with the terms you just mentioned, but I think it'd be great if you could just talk about the difference between efficiency and effectiveness.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a little pet hate of mine that people use those two terms interchangeably. It probably says more about me than it does about them. But the best way I've heard it explained is that effectiveness is about doing the right thing. So, you know, in marketing, having the right objective that is genuinely going to, you know, change your business and grow your business. Efficiency is then about doing that thing in the right way. So once you know you're sort of pointing in the right direction, getting there as quickly as possible.
And as cost effectively as possible, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. So, but you have to make sure you're pointed in the right direction. And I think that what happened with digital to some degree is that nobody bothered checking they were pointing in the right direction. They were just obsessed with, you know, really low cost inventory, hundreds of different metrics that you could measure on an hour by hour basis and pull the levers and change that and update that and optimize this, but not checking whether that optimization was towards the ultimate goal that business was trying to get to. So I think that's where it's gone slightly wrong.
Yeah, it's sort of instant and an expansive reach is yes. with digital enabled. And it's interesting that you talked about your direct response pre-internet when there were guys in the corner developing guys or men or women developing websites, because I was one of those guys way right. back when, and I actually got my start in direct response as it sort of transitioned online. So okay. it's all about driving some level of performance. And I know you've mentioned on one of the panels that we did together and how you've been influenced by sort of the godfathers of marketing effectiveness, Les Bennett and Peter Field and Byron Sharp. Could you talk to the audience about how that sort of influenced how you think about performance versus brand and, yeah. And how that's evolved over time?
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, coming from that direct response position, I probably had a lot of the falsehoods in my brain that lots of other people do, right? I was used to having a really direct link between the media budget that I'd put out into the world and seeing something come back. And so I was in that sort of frame of mind of, oh, brand is fluffy and it's just, you know, big TV ads and nobody really knows what it does. And it was reading marketing in the era of accountability in 2007 and then the sort of follow-up in 2013 of The Long and the Short of It by Bennett and Field. And it really started to make me think, well, it's not that brand isn't driving effects. It's just their effects you can't necessarily see in those immediate response channels, which used to be coupons and inserts and telephone calls, and had then become web visits and web sales and things like that online. And so it just started to make me think, well, maybe there is something behind that. You know, maybe it is just about that we're not measuring things properly. We're not thinking about how to determine whether something is having an effect. And digital had just kind of amplified that issue. And so those were the main, that was the sort of main turning point for me. And it became more about, okay, well, how can I help understand, how can I bring this kind of performance mindset that I've developed, this curiosity as to what's happening, how is it working, but apply that to all media. And then, you know, measurement becomes the missing piece. And so working and being introduced to econometricians in particular in one of the agencies that I worked at when I was at MEC, which is now Wavemaker in the UK, that was like a real sort of open mind moment for me of, my God, there is a way that we can actually track and understand how these things are driving, you know, business growth. This is amazing. We need to use more of this. And so that was, I suppose, the real starting point was being introduced to econometrics.
So it's interesting, you're talking about a couple of things in your response, which is you were talking about sort of certain channels being known as being more performance or brand-based channels. In the States, television advertising is a totally different ballgame than it is in the UK, I have to admit. It's pervasive in comparison to the UK. But that is the most common, I guess, channel where people say, oh, that's definitely brand advertising because it's a longer format. It's often more engaging and more video. You can do more explanation of what you're trying to convey in terms of the brand messaging. Do you think that that's still true, that there are certain channels that are tied to a sort of more, you know, brand and performance? Or is your vision that sort of, you know, all channels have the ability to deliver both higher upper funnel metrics as well as kind of the more actual lower funnel sort of activation and conversion?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a definite split. And so TV is a really interesting one because, again, back in the day when I was buying it, you had brand TV and you had direct response TV. And one of the things that really changed was because, you know, the idea was that someone had to get up, go to their hallway where most people's landlines were, then make a call. And so if you did that in the middle of a program that they really loved and were engaged with, it just wasn't going to happen. And so the cost, even though you were reaching so many more people in brand airtime, peak airtime, people weren't going to respond. So the cost per response just massively became cost inefficient versus direct response TV, where you were advertising in programs that no one could care less about. It's just like background filler noise. And so they didn't mind getting up. Obviously, online, digital devices, phones changed all that. And so actually, I think there was a tipping point somewhere back around 2010, 2011, whereby brand TV, peak time TV, could actually drive more response, more interest than direct response TV. So you kind of started to see a decline in direct response TV, because reaching more people was a good thing to do. More people saw you and they could show interest through just picking up their mobile and Googling your brand or going to your website. So TV was a really interesting one.
Can I double click on that? Because the when I think of direct response TV, I think of it as naturally limited in terms of the product or industry categories that it covers. It's the late night, you know, ab buster, right? That you know, and call right now to get this, and if you order in the next 10 minutes, you'll get a free X with your purchase.
Is that true in the UK though? I mean, do you find that's the same sort of category that oftentimes would pursue
So DLTV in the UK was always daytime from sort of nine.
And all the kids have gone to school.
Yeah.
All the moms that were at home.
Yeah. But also if you wanted, it generally fell into older targeted categories as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because, you know, people are retired and all the rest of it. And so they're watching more TV at home and then very late at night. So once you'd got past all the peak schedule and the TV everyone wanted to watch and you got into that sort of dead time. But yes, it was that, you know, rational messaging, strong call to action, phone number on the screen, call now, buy now, get your free pen, you know, whatever it happened to be. So yeah, absolutely. The same principles. I think one of the main differences in the US, which steadily made its way to the UK as most things do, was that really long form infomercial on TV. We never had those in the UK as much.
It was sort of direct response meets content marketing in a
basically,
sense.
Basically, yeah. And then eventually became, you know, QVC, right? It eventually becomes its own channel and it's just a 24-hour always on infomercial. So thanks for that.
You're welcome. Yeah. We give you the best things.
Oh,
you know?
All the best things. But I think that's when you also then move to the other side, which is, so there's a difference in brand and performance traditionally in the media channels used, but also in the types of creative and the messaging that are then used. And I think that's the other area that is starting to blur and should be merged together, because it's that idea that on the one hand, you just give this very emotional kind of message. And on the other hand, you just give this really rational message. But I think there is space to bring the two together. And I don't know if there's an equivalent in the US, but there's a brand in the UK called Go Compare, which is a car insurance comparison website, right? Price comparison website. And they were one of the first people I saw who played with that idea, because they had a very direct response ad in that it just mentioned the brand name over and over again in the form of a song, but it was being sung by a big opera singer, not a famous opera singer. When I say big, I mean physically big. rather than fame wise, although the guy has become incredibly famous in the UK. He was actually a Welsh opera singer, and he's become incredibly famous. And he's just singing Go Compare over and over again in a song. And they just showed that all day. And you did start to go, well, is that a brand ad because it's in the middle of peak airtime? Or is that direct response because it's just saying the brand name over and over and over again, which is enticing people to go there? And I think that was that first sort of merge, and where they literally went, we're just going to show this ad to everybody all the time. And the results were incredible. And that use of a brand, you know, like a brand ambassador, as it was, like a distinctive brand asset, as Mark Ritson would talk about it, in terms of the opera singer. That was actually in response, again, apologies for the US crowd who don't know who the meerkat is, but there was another brand called Compare the Market who'd created this animated meerkat and who had become their sort of brand ambassador, and they'd seen huge success. And so Go Compare introduced this opera singer and mimicked that success. So it's this merging of sort of brand and performance from a media execution, but also a creative point of view.
Yeah, and you are certainly referencing, you know, the Bennett and Field work, right, from long and short of it. I think I was reading an article recently that when they examined the data, they were expecting to find that basically kind of the halo effect argument, this combination of sort of emotive advertising, which we think of as brand advertising, and then the rational, which is sort of the call to action. What is the next step and how do I actually yes, you know, interact directly with this particular brand. And they were expecting to find that the combination is sort of the moneymaker. Like if you have a good balance between these two things, that's where you're going to see success. But the results were actually quite different. And I think it points to exactly what you just said in your two examples, is yes, they found that the more you moved away from rational messages, the call to action, direct response stuff, towards pure emotion, which is the opera singer's song, the more effective the advertising was. So I thought that was an interesting thing. They went in with one hypothesis. They came out with data that said, actually, the more emotional brand advertising is what drives performance, right? Which I thought was interesting.
Yeah. And I think there's always going to be, you know, I think there's a couple of things in there. And one of the criticisms that Burnett and Field always get is that they're using the IPA data bank and it's only award, not even award winning necessarily, but award submitted pieces of work. It did show that just going purely emotional drove the highest or the largest amount of business effects. But I like, and maybe this is just me, I like the idea of bringing the two things together, because I think it is important to touch on emotional, on human emotions and need states. That's for that memorability, which is that primary use of brand, is about mental availability. Mm-hmm. But I think it's important to then root the product benefits within that to drive distinctiveness, differentiation, and you know, prompt, even if you're not prompting action there and then, it's just instilling what that product is about in people's minds. And I think that that's where the gap between brand and performance has become too wide, and people have forgotten about an important middle section of, you've made yourself famous, you've told people where to buy you, but in some categories in particular, there's quite a long, you know, timeline between those two points in a consumer's journey, and they're receiving thousands of other messages in between. So how do you sort of keep them on track for you?
We recently have been doing some work with an organization in the US called the MMA. They're actually global. So they do have business in the UK as well, but they're sort of an industry body that we've been doing a lot of work with them around brand as performance and how actually brand-based advertising can deliver performance. And some of the research we did with a financial company called Ally Bank in the US, what we find is actually that brand-based advertising helps to enable the brand to deliver lower cost per acquisition, lower CAC, essentially, over time, because you're essentially keeping that messaging going. And so that when you do acquire customers, they're already a little bit more favorable to the brand. They're already more interested in the brand versus somebody yes, you're going kind of cold turkey with. Brett, you mentioned Byron Sharp, and I think I'm curious to hear your opinion on this. I think his research sort of suggested just get anybody you can into the brand as best you can. Yes. You know, it's really about customer penetration and just acquiring new customers.
But the bigger top of the funnel, yeah.
But there's smarter way to do it, is my point, is that how do you do that in a way that delivers more effectiveness and so that you're not just like dumping money and a lot of wasted impressions, a lot of wasted money into the ecosystem. And I think brand-based advertising can help you to lower that customer acquisition cost. I don't know if you agree with me around Byron's research and how that kind of differs versus what Les and Peter were sort of suggesting.
No, absolutely. I mean, yeah, and like everything, you know, there's balances and there's nuance within all of it. But that principle of reaching as many new potential customers as possible with your advertising, and focusing on new, right? There's mm-hmm. And this is the problem with digital. So I think where people misunderstood Byron Sharp was that he's talking about your marketing budgets and sort of paid media. Well, actually, I think he is trying to say you shouldn't bother trying to retain customers, but the way I interpreted it is you shouldn't spend your paid media budget on trying to retain customers, existing customers, or trying to get them to buy again, right? That is a job for your CRM program. And brand advertising does that as a side effect, because brand advertising, you know, broad reach, reaches everyone, which is going to include your existing customers, depending on the size of your brand and how niche you are. But let's say in general, if you run a TV ad, a proportion of those people are going to be existing customers. But that's just a side effect. That's a happy circumstance of brilliant. It sort of reinforces their decision-making. Look, we're with a great brand. Look how big and, you know, special they are. They can afford TV. They're reliable. Lots of people are seeing the same thing as me. That's reassuring to people from a social perspective, which is another effect of brand and mass reach, is you know that people are seeing the same thing that you are, right? And it sort of justifies your decisions. But in the majority, you're reaching new prospects. You know, you're prospecting in digital terms. And there's a lot of evidence and, you know, clients that I've worked on, brands that I've worked on, to show that the more, the higher the proportion of your overall reach that is new customer, like new prospects to the brand, the higher the incremental ROI that you will get from that channel when you look through MMM econometrics, right? So because you're reaching new people. The problem with digital advertising and the way that it's always been sold is that the algorithms look for the path of least resistance. And to what you were just saying there, Alison, the path of least resistance is people who are already warm to your brand, who have either already heard of you or are already using you. And so, although it sounds ridiculous, by targeting those people, you're driving a lot of customers to make purchases that they would have made without you spending that marketing budget.
Exactly.
Right. And so they're saying, hey, you know, it's these particular audiences, whatever you want to call them, are more likely to convert. And you're saying, that's precisely, this is kind of that movable middles argument.
So that's exactly what I was going to, you just, we've also done research with the MMA around this concept called movable middles, which
okay.
I think what you're describing is, you know, going after new customers, I completely agree with you, is the smartest way to drive incremental reach, essentially.
Yes.
What you're talking about is this incremental reach. So absolutely. People who are net new. But that group, that population, isn't all going to convert because some of them are just, you know, they're not category buyers. Maybe they're not in the category. I always use the diapers or nappies example because I'm a mom. But, you know, if you're spending a ton of money trying to sell nappies or diapers for my Americans, you're not going to sell them to people who do not have babies, right? It's a wasted impression. So I think that there is still this like cohort within that. I'm using probably a bad word because like cohort has so much meaning nowadays in the digital ecosystem. But there is a group or segment of consumers who is more favorable or more likely to be moved by that advertising. So how do you think about that idea? Because I think that's what most people have a hard time with when it comes to Byron is like, just go out and get anybody. But the reality is that there's going to be a lot of waste in that strategy.
And I think you're absolutely right. And I mean, there's lots of arguments that can be made as to whether terming it as wasted is the right way of terming it. I don't know. I just think getting into the idea of what's wasted is potentially another episode. I could definitely start rambling on that one. But I think that's where this middle ground. So there's two things. Yeah. There's where this middle ground. So if you think about the sort of three roles of advertising is, you know, make the brand famous, you know, get people to know who you are is brand. At the other end, you've got tell people where and how to buy you. That's performance. And then there's this middle bit, which is generate new demand against and a greater proportion of demand in the category for your brand. So to your point, out of all the people that are looking to buy diapers, get more of them to think about Pampers than brand X, right? And that's the bit that I think has been missed. And it gets missed by that very purist view of Byron Sharp, where you're up the just make you famous. Doesn't matter who you're being famous across. And the other sort of much more limited idea of everyone who's just ready to buy right now, let's speak to them. And then you miss your point about this. Messy middle. That's the Google.
We call them movable middles.
Exactly.
And that's getting back to the fundamentals of advertising that I think everyone forgot when digital came along, which is this is about influencing people's behaviors, right? And because in digital, at that bottom of the funnel, you were able to just pick up on that behavior that could have happened anyway and then claim that you moved it, that's where it got all its credit. And this is where digital has a hell of a lot of value. I often get criticized for saying digital's useless. It's not. It's just it's not as valuable in the way that everybody has considered it to be, which is right down the bottom of the funnel. Because in that mid-funnel section, you can have that targeting element of trying to find people who are more likely to be parents, you know, more likely to be in the market through all the different data signals that you can see. But the method of buying and the creative that you show them is much more in that brand space, because you're still trying to impact their decision making. So it's much more about video. It's high viewability. It's high impact creative formats. And where digital has come unstuck is that, let's say, using video prospecting in Meta. The problem that Meta had previously, back when it was called Facebook all those years ago, is that it had a very limited opportunity to drive performance on a sort of last click in-platform basis. And it was completely ignored as a brand driving opportunity because it had sold itself as sales, right? Then all of this thinking came around, which started to uncover the fact that actually it's a bit of a lie. Just counting what they're saying has happened in their platform is not a true version of reality, right? So once they started losing that, they were stuck. They had nothing left because they weren't respected as like a brand driving platform. So where they've moved to now is into this middle ground, but you can't clip, you can't judge the performance of videos in prospecting on clicks or anything else they'd formerly relied on. And so that's why they're moving into the MMM space with Robin, and they've focused a lot more on measurement and effectiveness over the last few years, because they need to justify to people that this other way of using their platform, which is incredibly effective, isn't seen as effective in the way that they told everyone it should be measured, which was how many sales did you generate, linking it to revenue. And so I think that movable middle is really the most interesting sector at the moment. And it's where people are finding the most challenges. And it's where this change in measurement approach is needed to be able to justify its importance in that overall mix across the customer journey. And it's the bit that I think has been missing the most. Therefore it's the most exciting. It's the bit that people don't feel like they've fixed or they've conquered. And I think it's the area where it drives the most value. And certainly when I worked on O2, developing, which is a telco in the UK, was developing that middle section and proving to them through econometrics that actually that drove the highest incremental ROI of any activity was that middle piece. So not the pure brand, not the pure performance as they'd been doing it. And actually on O2, we got to a stage where search was the only channel that I let anybody call performance. Everything else was in the middle.
I want to go back to something that you said a little bit earlier around you're sort of distinguishing between paid media and what we'll sort of define as marketing, from awareness to the middle section, right? I guess influence and consideration to conversion, which is the down funnel piece of it. And I want to sort of broaden this out and say, well, where does customer lifetime value fit in? Now, you mentioned before that that's a CRM function, but is there, in your opinion, a change of guard in terms of not only how CMOs are defining their jobs, where they're sort of chief customer officers, and they have to be sort of hyper-focused on, you know, customer lifetime value, what is that? And how much of that includes their experience after a conversion event, after a purchase, right? So they've bought a car, they've bought a bike, they've bought an X, and then there's this lifetime of experience that they have because, you know, with the brand, and they might be repeat buyers, there might be upsell, cross-sell opportunities. How do you define and see the importance of sort of customer lifetime value in sort of how we think about paid media, but kind of the overarching experience that we have with customers, with brands?
Sure. No, I mean, that's obviously really important. And I think that's where then the experience, and it becomes the brand's responsibility, right, to maintain that relationship and make sure that experience is as seamless and excellent as possible in order to try and help retain that customer. I think this is where Byron Sharp comes back in, where he kind of says, it doesn't matter what you do, right? It doesn't matter what you do outside of maybe handing that customer large wadges of cash on a regular basis. You know, you're always going to lose a certain amount of people because people like to move about. They like to go to different brands, try different things, all that sort of stuff, right?
Do you believe that?
Well, I mean, as a consumer myself, absolutely. You know, I have great experiences with brands, but I still try other things, you know, And I think that there was a great report. Google actually did an amazing job of producing some really interesting reports over the kind of lockdown and COVID period. One was the messy middle, which was sort of just before COVID hit in 2020. But there was a couple of I can't remember the names of the reports now, but there were a couple of sort of shopping behavior reports that they produced. And they showed that across, I think it was beauty and fashion were two of the categories I can remember. The percentage of people that were saying they were trying new brands was enormous, right? Because people are sat at home all day, surfing the internet, pretending to work remotely. And they just discovered a lot more brands, and brands had to shift their behavior to be online if they hadn't previously. Loads of brands shifted to get an omnichannel presence and get an e-commerce presence. And ironically, brand became even more important because you had to be distinctive when there's, 10,000 new brands that are now in your space. You had to be distinctive and you had to be different and you had to be visible as a brand. So brand advertising, ironically, as everyone shifted online, that brand advertising became even more important. And I think going back to something I said earlier, that reassurance that you give when you're broad reach and you are talking to your existing customers, even though not specifically, but they get sort of caught up in that broad reach that you're
creating. That halo, yeah.
That halo, absolutely. You're reassuring them, you're reassuring them that they're with a good brand that is stable, that is reliable, that is trustworthy, that is big enough to be advertised on TV. Their friends, their family, their colleagues are seeing that brand being advertised. And so even if it's not a brand or a category that you'd necessarily talk to other people about, you feel a sort of sense of community that other people are seeing the same message as you and you are with them. You've made that smart decision already.
Well, I get that. So you're part of a community. You've got this overarching halo effect, yeah, of like, hey, I'm an Adidas loyalist. Back to when I listened to Run DMC in 1988, those my Adidas shoes. I was just like, I want that. But I think to connect brand to performance, you've got the brand halo effect. You're like, hey, there's something aspirational, emotive about this that I can continue to feel connected to for reasons other than sort of performance marketing purposes.
Sure. Yep.
But the second, and this is the argument that Forrester's come out with some reports that have talked about this relatively recently, that consumers, especially younger generation, younger than us, consumers are extremely fickle and more likely to switch than their older counterparts. Mm. And they're very picky about brand consistency. So the second I get a direct response mailer from, let's say, a financial company that is something that I already purchased from that company, is the second that I say, they don't know who I am. They've got a messed up data strategy. They don't know that I'm an existing customer. I'm leaving, right? So do you think that there's a because to me that's a challenge if they're inconsistently interacting with you because they don't know what you've done from a past purchase perspective, from an engagement perspective, that delivers a bad experience, right?
No, definitely, and I think that's where it comes to that CRM and the technology that companies now have access to on a much more open basis. Cost is still a barrier in some cases, but I don't think it's that difficult to do a relatively good job of in your owned environment, being able to demonstrate to somebody that you recognize that they're an existing customer and this is the last thing that you did. It's always a bit disingenuous to give Amazon as an example, right? But I think for normal companies who aren't Amazon and don't have a global dominance, they do have to be more considered. And there's a part of me that thinks, well, I don't see why they wouldn't be. Why wouldn't you just care that little bit to just be able to say, hey, Brett, we saw you've just done this and you've had it for 3 months and that tends to be when it starts to wear out. How about topping up Here's the new Adidas shoe that's coming out. We're giving you first look, or just something that makes you feel better about the brand. And then there's the reinforcing halo effect, but you can't underestimate that experience. And it always annoys me when people apply a Net Promoter Score, NPS, as a metric that paid media should be measured by, right? Because I could do the best advertising in the world, Amazon excluded. And so, for example, I used to work on a bank account one of the big banks in the UK, and they shut everybody's bank accounts down for 2 weeks, right? Some error internally, no one could access their bank accounts for 2 weeks. There is no advertising in the world that could overcome the amount of hate. Their NPS score dropped off a cliff. It doesn't matter what you say on a TV ad. You turned everyone's bank accounts off. They're going to hate you. It's just one of those things. So NPS, I think, should never be tied to paid media, because paid media is a tiny, tiny proportion of what drives existing customer satisfaction. That's all about the experience.
Well, and to your point earlier, you've been sort of promoting this idea that paid media also shouldn't be the mechanism that you use to drive Net Promoter Score, because you should be using it to drive new customer acquisition. And inherently, new customers are going to have no promoter score of your product because they've never used it. So I think that those are just two totally different strategies. To your point, you should have a strategy for customer retention and customer lifetime value that can be supported by halo effect from your brand advertising, your paid media, but your paid media really should be tied to customer acquisition, is what I'm hearing you say.
But again, that's the importance of brand again for those new customers, is that you're giving them a perception of the brand. You're giving them an idea of what the brand is, what it's about, what it supports, what it's for. And you can't do that really in a performance ad as well as you can in a brand broad reach brand ad. So it's like the other side of the coin for Net Promoter Score is, here's the experience once you're with us, but here's the dream of the experience that we're selling you up front to make you give us a go in the first place.
So you're teasing out a question that I wanted to ask that I've been kind of holding on to, which is, how do you measure that? Because you're talking about basically brand equity measurements. Like there's a company in the States that we work with that talks about it as brand love. There's a lot of different metrics you can use to measure sort of that brand emotional reaction, is kind of where you're kind of getting to. Are those the metrics we should be using to validate paid media in our measurement capabilities, or are there other, like, what metrics do you think are most valuable today?
So I was in a pitch once and I was asked that question directly, like, which metrics do you think are the best ones for us to use? And I said, the best metrics to use are the ones that you can align to your business objectives, right? So brand health metrics are a great example. If you want to push awareness up 10 points, nobody wants to push their awareness up 10 points for the sake of pushing their awareness up 10 points. They want to do it because they know at some point in time that is going to translate to sales, revenue, market share.
Especially in a short time period. You know, it's like the time period. What is the timed horizon of that?
Well, I mean, that's, you know, there's a $6 million question in that, you know, people have different ideas of what long-term and short-term should be. So there's a bit of a misnomer again, and a bit of false advertising on the advertising industry's part, which is that brand is only for long term, right? If you want to see your brand health metrics go up in 18 months, do brand, but actually brand will sell you stuff tomorrow. Again, you won't be able to create that direct link, but it is happening. But that's what most people are looking at, right? They're looking at probably a year to 18 months, so that you're going to build your base sales through that brand activity, that mental availability, that fame. And by building your base sales through that brand activity, the performance activity that you do at that point in time is going to be that much more efficient, because you're just adding incremental sales on top, but your base has been building. When people don't have things like econometrics, what happens is that the digital marketing team are slapping each other on the back and high-fiving about the fact that they've, you know, just got a CPA of £3.50, and nobody ever decided if £3.50 was the right CPA. It's just really low, so that's good. $3.50, sorry. And meanwhile, the CFO is just looking at the general trend of revenue for the business going down, 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 and the base sales are going down, 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 but nobody can see it because they're just looking at those ones that they're monitoring through paid media activity. So I think that brand metrics are incredibly important. Brand health metrics are incredibly important. But you do need some fairly complex modeling work, mainly through regression analysis and variations of econometrics, to be able to link those brand metrics to sales and revenue. But I do think it's important that people do that work, because for each brand, there will be different brand health metrics that are more important to them at a given point in time. So, you know, again, if you're Adidas, brand awareness is not your issue. Like, if people aren't buying your trainers, it's not because they haven't heard of you. So pushing brand awareness up another 10 points is probably impossible, right? Let alone difficult. What they're probably struggling with is consideration. And then linked to consideration will be a whole host of brand perceptions that are more or less important to potential buyers, which make them consider Adidas. And so you then have to break down, well, which of those perception metrics are the most important? So we've identified consideration is important, and it is very closely linked to revenue in the future. A strong perception metric is Adidas is a brand for me, or something like that, or is good value, or is whatever the perception metric is. That is incredibly important. We need more of that because we're scoring low versus our competitors. And so that then goes through to your media and messaging. So we need to talk about Adidas like this, because that will up that score, which will up consideration, which will up revenue. So I do think it's incredibly important, but to your point, it is much harder to get to. And brand equity modeling is the way to do that.
Yeah. You know, we actually are seeing a lot of brands thinking about Google search volume as a way to kind of help understand if consumers are actually considering the brand, because to your point, that's oftentimes a last experience that you might do. So we've been doing a lot of work with Google and have, you know, direct partnership with them to capture some of that data so we can model it as an indication of that brand awareness and that brand consideration. I think we found it's a pretty strong indicator.
And, you know, not everyone can afford econometrics. I think it's a lot cheaper than some people think it is, but it's still, you know, a big chunk of money if you've got, you know, relatively small marketing budgets. But I don't think that should put people off trying it. And there's lots of, you know, leading indicators and metrics that you will have through digital channels that can help you identify what seems to be working. So although not perfect, you know, many of the big platforms offer brand lift studies or conversion lift studies, which again, they're siloed, but they're better than relying on last click. To your point, search, you know, brand search query volumes. You know, if we've got a period where we've done nothing and we change something, we do TV or we do Facebook video, video prospecting, do we see number of searches for our brand increase? Do we see more organic referral direct traffic through our Google Analytics during that period? Like, what are the leading indicators that aren't directly linked, but you can make a sensible guess that, okay, we did this and this happened, and the two aren't linked, but there was nothing else really that was going on at the time. And I think people need to make use of those, you know, just being curious, just what data do we have access to? What's the stuff that if it changes, it might indicate that something we're doing that's different is working. And if you've got the money, brilliant, go for, you know, full-blown brand equity or econometrics. But there's lots of other things that people can do, lots of experimentation that can be done in the meantime to get towards these answers.
Yeah. And do you think that short-term, because you've been talking a lot about connecting the dots and how difficult that is, and how there's really a lot of math behind saying, what is the brand impact on overall revenue in over a long period of time? Do you think short-termism kind of gets in the way of companies making shifts? Because there's always been this promise, I think, with digital advertising. We see this with a lot of our big bank clients, right? Financial services, Ally, we mentioned before, where they continue to focus on the down funnel. An overwhelming amount of their budget spend is on the down funnel direct response, largely direct mail driven channels. And despite the math over years and years of experience and consulting with them, that suggests that a different mix, the movable middles, right, upper funnel mix with the halo effect on will have a material impact on ROI at the lower funnel, which you've hinted at before. You're saying, hey, if you've got that standard brand awareness around a new product that you're bringing to market, let's say a new credit card, that halo effect's going to impact the actual performance of the direct mailer or the performance of the email or whatever direct response medium you're using. But we're finding that the math is there to prove it out, especially with the big organizations that can invest in that intelligence.
Yes.
But there's an unwillingness or a slowness in terms of changing.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you see that within certain industry categories. We see it a lot in financial services, automotive to a degree. And how are you seeing that change happening within different industry categories, right? And is it faster in some and slower in others?
I mean, I think it's part of that creation of silos that's happened. So that's an important thing, right? In that you will have a digital marketing team. You'll probably have a CRM team who are in charge of the direct mails, and you've got a brand team, and they've all been pitted against each other in some weird Game of Thrones scenario where they're all fighting for this ever decreasing budget pot. And they're just set against each other competing for that. So what happens is they become entrenched in the best way of them proving that they cause that next sale to happen. And they're completely disinterested in if that isn't necessarily the case, because they're all incentivized. They're all bonused on number of sales that could be counted through the digital channel or through the CRM channel, or brand are completely buggered in that respect because they haven't got a hope. They can't prove anything, right? There's sort of unintended consequence of it, of bad incentivization. But because you split all these people up rather than having them work together where they might be more willing to kind of share knowledge, share experience and really try and get to the truth. And any business that is being judged on a very short-term basis. So, any company that's trying to hit weekly sales targets or has to report to, the stock exchange on a quarterly basis or shareholders or on monthly or quarterly basis, they've just become addicted to these fast moving metrics. And it's very easy and it's very difficult for them to start trying to turn that around. Because number one, the first thing that happens is people say, well, were you wrong before then? Again, this very black and white idea of you're either right or wrong. And the search for the truth becomes problematic because, it's like scientists are always the quietest people in the room because they're thinking it through and they don't want to be wrong because they know that ordinary people, if they change their mind, it's like, ha ha, you were wrong.
Yeah, and that might be a recency bias or otherwise,
absolutely.
Right?
Yeah, and I mean, it's why you get, all of these, horrible global kind of lies that spread, that idea that lies spread quicker than truth. Is because the people that are telling lies have all the confidence in the world to just shout them out. They're not worried about being proven wrong. And all the experts and the scientists are like, well, I'm not sure because, blah, blah, there's nuance and nobody wants to hear nuance.
No, they want that confidence. Well, so I think it's interesting what you're saying, Matt, which is there's all these challenges and all these hurdles about why, people aren't doing it. So how would you recommend they get started and giving it a go?
So, I mean, I think it's creating like a measurement framework, right? Like a KPI framework. And even at a simple level, having those three kind of buckets of generate future demand, generate a greater proportion of in-market demand for your brand, and then harvest existing demand. And just work through to kind of go, okay, like as a consumer even, or just if you've read a bit of the literature or whatever it is, what in my business... what do I think is the data points that I have that I can fit under those three buckets that I think would point to whether I'm being successful? So all of those leading indicators, website traffic, brand search query increases, click-through rate increases. You do a big piece of brand and you see that your search click-through rate goes up, or your display ad click-through rate goes up. Like maybe it's because people are, they've seen you before and they're more inclined to sort of react to that new ad that they're seeing. So try and think about, what data have I got that points to those different areas? And then to the point we were just making about sort of timelines, what am I being judged by, right? We've all got to be pragmatic. And if we are being judged on weekly sales targets, no one's going to give us 6 months to prove anything, You know, it's not going to happen. So think about the experiments or the you know, the tests that you can do in the short term that can try and start to prove your point in the timeframes that you're going to be judged on. So, you know, it's just start somewhere. Get this kind of view in your head of how these things affect your particular business, what data you have access to already, that you could just create a timeline of and start to look for shifts as you're doing different things, even just eyeballing it, you know, or do even like, even I'm horrific at Excel, but even I know how to do like a scatter graph and then a correlation analysis. It's really, if I can do it, pretty much anyone can do it. And again, it just gives you those hypotheses to then start working on and start to try and gain traction within the business to give you the opportunity to then just investigate some of those hypotheses.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. You have to start with tracking the data, getting the right KPIs in order, and then start to sort of reset expectations around what a measurement framework should be delivering and what the advertising should be delivering for your business. Well, Matt, you know, we really enjoyed talking with you. I think we could have talked to you forever. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today.
No, you're very welcome.